Hello, everyone, and welcome to Litigation Radio. I'm your host, Dave Scriven-Young. I'm a commercial and environmental litigator in the Chicago office of Picar & Abramson, which is recognized as the largest law firm serving the construction industry with 115 lawyers and 11 offices around the U.S. On this show, we talk to the country's top litigators and judges to discover best practices in developing our careers, winning cases, getting more clients, and building a sustainable practice. Please be sure to subscribe to the podcast in your favorite podcasting app to make sure that you're getting updated with future episodes. This podcast is brought to you by the litigation section of the American Bar Association. It's where I make my home in the ABA. The litigation section provides litigators of all practice areas the resources we need to be successful advocates for our clients. Learn more at ambar.org/litigation. Trial by jury is a basic American right, yet many people think that jury duty is a tedious, time-consuming endeavor. But that's probably because people view jury service as just waiting around the courthouse and never being called into a courtroom. That's been my experience, at least, every time I've been called for jury duty. But for litigators, we relish the chance to serve on a jury to allow us to see a trial through the eyes of a juror. Today's guest is Shantice Jenkins Floyd, who is an experienced litigator and a longtime leader of the ABA litigation section, serving the section for the past 4 years as the chief diversity officer. She was lucky enough to serve on a jury recently and will tell us her perspective. Over the past 20 years, Shantice has developed an extensive trial and litigation practice, representing national and local corporations in litigation involving insurance coverage, insurance defense, premise liability, merchant retail liability, products liability, labor and employment, procurement and intellectual property law in state and federal court. She's currently senior counsel at Travelers, previously founded the Jenkins Floyd Law Firm, and was a former partner of Porteous, Henkel & Johnson Law Firm in New Orleans, Louisiana. Welcome to the show, Shantice.
Hi, Dave. I am super excited to be here.
Well, I'm super excited to have you on the show. It's been too long, and you're somebody that we've wanted to have on for quite some time. So we're really interested to hear about the case that you have served on a jury for. So tell us a little bit about your experience. Tell us, first of all, about the case. What was the case about?
Sure. I was selected to be a juror in probate court involving a case with dealing with generational wealth. The petitioner was the wife of the decedent. She sought to probate the will of her late husband. The natural children of the decedent were from his first marriage, and they made a claim of undue influence and sought to invalidate the will. Now, just a little background. To invalidate a will in Georgia, the undue influence must amount to deception, coercion that destroys the testator's free will. So I reported for jury duty on a Monday and got selected the same day, and we reached a decision, a verdict, on Thursday of the same week.
Wow. Okay. So tell us about kind of the jury selection process. So tell us, first of all, like, have you been called for jury duty before? And I know you're, you know, originally maybe from New Orleans. Have you been called before? Have you served before? Tell us a bit about your previous jury experience.
Sure. Just as a point of order, the opinions I express here today are my own and do not necessarily reflect the views of my employer. Let me say that when I arrived at the courthouse, I arrived with absolutely no expectation that I would be selected as a juror. I have been called to be a juror many times in my lifetime, and I've been excused due to legitimate work obligations, or I've never made it past the jury pool room. It only took 25 years after graduating from law school to be selected. So I guess this was a present, but it really was a great compliment to my career. I found, to my delight, the jury selection process went quite smoothly, yet it was different compared to what I experienced in New Orleans versus now here in Georgia, in the greater Atlanta area. For instance, I only made it to the jury pool room and never made it beforehand. So in this instance, one of the Superior Court judges came to the jury pool room before our names were called to thank the entire pool for showing up.
Wow.
I've never seen that done before, and explained the jury duty process, why it was important to our community and society as a whole. And this was, as I said, the first time I've never seen this done. And I was really impressed by this thoughtful extra step and gesture to educate everyone and to manage expectations. Because as you might suspect, some were very patient, and then there were others who were friendly, yet were very vocal about their desire to leave sooner rather than later. Right. So they were talking about childcare obligations and missing work. And it really was, you know, a friendly conversation, but you could tell that some people just really wanted to leave. We were told that there were going to be two trials that began that week, one in probate court and the other one in state court. So again, I'm sitting there, I'm waiting to not be called and thinking about what I was going to do or had to do in the office that day. And so when I heard my name, I was honestly shocked. Got up, lined up to be escorted to one of the courtrooms. And I was just really all eyes and ears from that point. Because again, I'd never made it past the jury pool room. And so I just really observed everyone around me. And everyone was friendly. And just going into the courtroom, how we were lined up, how we were organized by the bailiff, everything, all of my senses were tingling, right? Because I'm a trial lawyer and I never get to see this part because I'm sitting at one of the tables in the front, talking to my clients, looking over, you know, my outlines, making sure all of my exhibits are marked. I'm not paying attention to that aspect. So it just was really great to just take it all in and understand how each step is so very important and critical to a smooth process for when the attorneys began to conduct voir dire.
Well, let me jump in and ask just a couple of follow-ups because I think it's really fascinating that a judge came in and talked to the jury pool beforehand. My only experience is in Cook County, Illinois. And the last time I was there, essentially everything was videos. So you'd walk in and there'd be a welcome video and then kind of a video showing you what to expect. And it all was kind of, I don't know, remote and vague, and as if, yes, they're kind of playing lip service to the fact that jury service matters, but I would have loved to seen, you know, somebody come in and actually make that personal pitch and thank you, like it happened with you. I mean, that sounds, it was a special moment.
It was, and I really commend the judge for how she handled that because it helped to soothe and comfort those who are a little restless and underscored the importance and value of them being there and how appreciated that they were. I have not had the opportunity to appear before her since then, but I will make a personal effort to let her know how effective I thought that was and just how she stood out just compared to my other experiences.
Yeah, I love that. And yeah, you mentioned, you know, your experiences sitting at trial counsel table, and obviously you're at Travelers now, and I'm sure, you know, none of what you're about to say is the opinion of Travelers, but it's, of course, your own opinion of what happened that day. The first impressions you had of the lawyers, and you mentioned, you know, when the jury walks in, you're not necessarily paying that close attention to the whole pool. What were your kind of your first impressions of the lawyers as y'all walked in?
So this goes back to kind of my experience as a young lawyer before I ever came to Travelers, about once the jury is selected and once they walk in that room, the trial begins before you even ask a question. Because the jury, at least what I did, I started observing them immediately. Who are the parties on sitting to my left? Who are the parties sitting to my right? Eye contact is so important. Body language was so important. And so the two lawyers who were there struck me immediately as being very acutely aware, very prepared, in touch with their clients. They seemed to have a camaraderie with them. Their body language was someone who was concerned, who knew them, who was willing to talk with them. So they looked very prepared. And when they began with voir dire, I automatically knew who was the trial lawyer and who had more experience as a trial lawyer and who did not. And I don't know of any of them personally, but one person in particular just struck me just with his demeanor, his ease, the inflection in which he asked questions. He knew that, okay, me arguing my case starts right here, planting seeds about what this case is about, how this potentially affects my client, what the issues are, were reflected in his questions. Now, the other lawyer did a good job as well, but I could tell that one was more familiar than the other. And it made me think about the golden rule. As litigators, as trial lawyers, we all know what the golden rule is. It's improper to ask jurors to place themselves in the victim's shoes because the jurors are supposed to make their decision based on the facts and the evidence of the case. However, a great trial lawyer, an experienced trial lawyer, knows that although that golden rule exists, the way you ask questions during voir dire, you give the jury certain ideas, issues about what's going to be important, and you're actually indirectly asking them to put themselves in the role without doing so and breaking that golden rule. There's a savvy to doing that, and there's a careful line to walk. And I found that both lawyers did a very good job of presenting the issues, important facts in each of their case and the questions that they asked so that afterwards, I was like, I know exactly what this case is about. It's going to come down to this versus that. And surprisingly, so did my fellow jurors.
Okay, so tell me more about that, because you know what to expect walking into voir dire, but the other jurors may not. And were there certain questions that they found more interesting than others? Were there some questions that they found off-putting? Would love to hear more about kind of what your fellow jurors said about the voir dire process.
The questions, so there were general, of course, we always ask general questions, like, does anyone know this party, or have you had any experience with them, et cetera? You know, general questions like that. But the specific questions that had to do with it, has anyone been a caretaker? Has anyone been a caretaker of someone who passed away? Does anyone believe that just because you took care of someone, you should be, took care of a family member, you should be compensated or left something in the will? Those specific types of questions elicited a lot of responses. Because again, you're trying to draw out, the strategy was, who has that experience with wills or being a caretaker of someone who passed away? Those were important issues to both parties, both lawyers in the case. So there were a lot of people in that pool who responded, and they were very candid and honest about how it made them feel. And some of those responses were, yes, I think they do deserve X, Y, and Z. And then some were like, no, that's a family member. And even though those questions were asked in the room before we were ultimately in the courtroom, before we were ultimately selected, it carried on past that. So those seeds, those issues were planted in the minds of many that it evoked emotion. And I think it also influenced them early on. I was very surprised about how early on they were influenced just by the voir dire questions without one iota of evidence, underscoring how important that initial process is.
Absolutely. And so tell us, you know, generally, obviously don't name names or anything like that, but generally, what other, you know, types of jobs did you see your fellow jurors have? So you had obviously one lawyer on the panel. Who else was represented?
Well, this probably was the most unique panel ever because there were two lawyers on the panel.
Oh, no kidding.
Myself and another retired lawyer. There was one physician. Someone who had a very specific scientific background. And everyone was a professional. Okay? And in their own form or fashion. And I mean, they were diverse in a number of different ways, including the fact that there were only 3 women and 9 men. Now, from a trial lawyer standpoint, that's important to me because I'm trying to figure out why they're choosing this person. And the decedent in this particular case was a man. So having 9 men, both sides clearly agree that a male being in this process and a part of the deliberation was extremely important. Their thought process was, I think, very influential, or at least the attorneys thought so. Only having 3 women was interesting as well to me. It really just made me think about, again, the dynamics and what their strategy was. But yeah, we had a very great panel, very analytical group of professionals.
Yeah, it sounds like it. And how did the judge handle challenges, and what were your fellow jurors kind of thinking? What were you thinking as, you know, folks got challenged and perhaps removed from the jury?
Well, you know, the way that juries are selected in Georgia in comparison to my home state of Louisiana is a little different, because in Georgia, you strike jurors. And the ones that you have left are ultimately the ones who continue on to be served. So I didn't get to hear the good stuff. The challenges, right? We weren't privy to all of that. But the process of, again, selecting the jurors, actually, I mean, we were able to do that. And it was finished, I think, right before we took a break for lunch. So maybe about 3 or 4 hours. It did not take as long as I thought, but it went very smoothly. And again, all of the attorneys were very professional, very courteous. And so if there were any major challenges, I didn't know about them, but from a technical standpoint, listening to the responses of jurors who clearly said, I don't want to be here, I cannot be fair and impartial, you already knew who was going to be, you know, have a peremptory strike versus for cause, etc. I could listen to the responses and make those predictions. And that was fun for me to do, right? Like, because I knew what might be coming just based listening to what others had to say.
Okay, so let's talk more about, you know, what happened during the trial. You know, we don't need to go through, you know, moment by moment, but just generally, you know, sitting through the trial as a juror, what, I guess, surprised you the most as, you know, being a juror as opposed to being a litigator?
Well, I talked a little bit about the whole golden rule dichotomy, right? And how during voir dire, really and truly, you make an impression upon the jury. It's not made, you do. And so carefully draft your questions. You know, they don't end in the courtroom when the jury is being selected. They carry on. So you need to think about that. The seeds you plant carry on throughout the entire trial. Never underestimate the impact of personal knowledge versus hard evidence. This case, being a probate case, of course, dealt with a lot of testimony about what the decedent desired, what he intended, what he wanted ultimately, versus what the actual parties thought. And although we had several wills and other hard evidence to examine, circumstantial evidence and the testimony and the emotion that came from that testimony was very, very persuasive in this probate case. And of course, depending on, you know, what type of litigator you are, we all know that that also can carry weight in other type of cases as well. But you should never underestimate that. And choosing your witnesses carefully was important in this case. You know, for something such as undue influence, as a lawyer, I would have expected more expert testimony to be presented about an undue influence. And that wasn't present in this particular case. I'm not sure any of my fellow jurors picked up on that, but to me, that was an element that I expected to see, and there was not much of. Jurors watch and see everything. I knew this, but I really got to understand that they do. They notice who was in court, who was not in court, body language, facial expression. You know, at one point, comments that were made about one of the parties just appearing very cold until she took the stand and gave her version and her testimony, and how quickly that changed the sentiment. So they draw conclusions very early on. And so laying out your case as a litigator very strategically and anticipating, you know, knowing your client, and taking a step back and looking at your client and thinking about how are he and she being perceived? How did their testimony come across objectively versus what you think it should mean is important. And I think one of the lawyers did a very good job in making sure that was balanced compared to the others. So every aspect becomes important because jurors are watching and seeing everything. And I personally, that was important to me. Whenever a question was asked, I would pivot and look at the party to see how they reacted. Because you're trying to weigh the veracity of every statement, all the evidence, and how they reacted to it. And so that really helped me. And I think my other fellow jurors noticed that as well.
You talked about emotion being involved, and probably nothing is more emotionally charged than, you know, a family dispute, certainly after the death of a family member. But yet you had a analytical jurors, doctors, lawyers, professionals. How did you weigh that emotional component as opposed to looking at it analytically and you trying to follow the law? Did you find yourself emotionally swayed at all by any of the parties or any of the lawyers?
As a lawyer, I was determined to examine every piece of evidence because I know how much effort goes into gathering evidence, you know, submitting it properly before the court. I just felt obligated to do that for the other fellow attorneys in this case. And surprisingly, so did the other jurors. Comb through everything. And I always question that, like, do they actually look at it? However, an important aspect of this case was, again, what did the decedent really want? This case involved multiple wills, and the very last will that he changed was right before his death. And we were trying to determine, we read everything, what did he really want? And there was one piece of evidence, a text message that he wrote to his wife in the middle of the night about how he felt about her, how important she was, and how important their relationship was. And one of the jurors actually, in the middle of the deliberation, raised up this piece of evidence and said, we keep talking about what he want. He said what he wanted right here. That, to me, was one of many pivotal moments about how we evaluated the emotional aspect in determining whether or not, you know, there was undue influence or not. And so I was impressed by my fellow jurors and the time and effort that they put into that. And that one person in particular was like, here's the answer right here. This is a great reflection. And so we balanced that with, of course, the instructions from the court and what the actual law was. But it made me think that this is just, again, a reflection of what actually happens to some degree in many cases. And so don't underestimate the ability for the jury to analyze documents and listen to the emotional aspects to reach a decision that they believe is fair and just. And another thing that really impressed me or that stood out to me was objections. We know as litigators how important it is to preserve the record, right? Because of a potential appeal. One lawyer in particular was spot on with just about every objection. He was surgical, and you could tell he was very well versed with the rules of evidence. However, I do think at some point, the multiple objections began to have a negative effect upon the jurors. Not sure how he knew that, but again, I think that being a really good trial lawyer, he read the jury, he read some expressions, and maybe he anticipated that I don't want this to come across the wrong way. And during his closing, he actually addressed it, which I thought was brilliant because I think it was effective in explaining to the juror why objections are necessary, why it carries weight. And again, I thought it was a nice touch that I had never seen done before. Like lawyers were taught not to apologize for something, especially depending on what it is at court, but he did it so thoughtfully that it left a really, really great impression.
That's so smart. Let's talk a little bit about the jury deliberations. So before you deliberated, I'm sure the judge gave some instructions. And tell us a little bit about the instruction process, but also, more importantly, how the instructions played a role in guiding your deliberations and decision-making as a juror.
It was clear to me as a litigator that all the parties had reviewed the instructions beforehand and had weighed in on that. And the judge did a good job of delivering those instructions to the entire jury. We were allowed, you know, to have certain information when we went back into the jury room, you know, with our notes. That was so important because, again, this was the first time for many of them serving on a juror. So knowing what we should consider, what is not evidence, how the deliberations will take place, that's just important. It made the process smoother. We did have questions along the way, and we were able to share that with the judge accordingly, according to the rules, and the judge provided a response expeditiously. So that was really important, and I made many mental notes during this process, but just to make sure that the instructions are clear in layman's terms, not lawyer terms, right?
And I had a question about that because so you had two lawyers in the room. Were the two lawyers kind of taking the lead in explaining what those instructions were, or did you find that the instructions were so clear that that wasn't necessary?
Well, as fate would have it, I ended up being the jury foreman.
Of course you did.
But the other lawyer in the room did assist. Yes, we worked together to explain exactly what the judge meant. So I think that really was to the benefit of everyone in the room. And we didn't get any pushback about that. I was thankful that they kind of trusted us, that we knew what we were talking about. But I also think in combination with how they were crafted, it made it easier. And I, you know, again, just through experience, you've seen some situations where they're not as clear. And the jury keeps going, coming back and forth because they don't understand that. We didn't have a lot of that, thankfully.
Tell us a little bit about kind of the dynamics of the jurors during deliberations. Were there any particular disagreements or, and you don't have to get into the specifics, obviously, because, you know, you want to keep it confidential to the extent that you have to. But you tell us generally about how things went during the deliberations.
Well, I will say that I was pleasantly surprised at the sense of camaraderie that we developed over a very short period of time. And I don't know what I actually thought about how jurors got along, but everyone got along. Everyone was very, you know, respectful, thoughtful. I was impressed by the analytical skills of each of these jurors, and I now understand why, to a large degree, why they chose people with the backgrounds that they had. Most of the people in their roles were leaders. They had analytical roles, and it really helped in this particular case where details were important, interpretation was important. And so the way that we deliberated was in a very fair process. everyone was able to communicate how they felt about particular issues. We listened. There wasn't a matter of cutting anyone off. It was just a very respectful process. And again, I was all ears and eyes listening to everything because I just really wanted to understand how everyone processed the information. Understanding that, you know, every case is different, every jury pool is different. But it really, really went well. But it was really great discussion and analyzing every aspect of the law. We talked about, you know, what certain laws meant and how to reach a conclusion. And what I really walked away from was feeling that it was a good faith effort by everyone. I didn't feel like anybody was a slacker, right? Or anybody was just following the leader. No, we all were vested and felt strongly about our positions and our thoughts, but we were able to come together and, you know, come to a consensus and do what we felt was fair and right in this particular situation.
How did the voting kind of take place on the final verdict? And again, I've never served on a jury, so my only impression is what I get from TV and from movies, which is sometimes you see in movies and TVs, as soon as they get into the jury room, they take like a preliminary vote and then they deliberate. Did you guys do that? And then how did you kind of come to a final conclusion? Was it a like secret ballot sort of thing or raise of hands? Or tell us a little bit about how that took place.
We decided to, unanimously, we decided to allot a certain amount of time for everybody to review the evidence first, look over everything. And then we went one by one and talked about what we thought. While each person spoke afterwards, as the jury foreman, I just kind of tried to make sure that we were being respectful and let everybody have their time. We asked questions after every person spoke and went one by one. And then we had a full discussion about which direction we wanted to go in. And we were not unanimous every time, but eventually our final vote, we were unanimous and reached a consensus about it.
You got there. Okay. Well, Shantice, this has been a great conversation. And I'm sorry to say that we're at the end of our time together. Really, any last thoughts that you might have for our listeners on the lessons that you learned during your experience serving on a jury?
Yes. I am so glad that I did it. This was just a great opportunity. I was impressed by and really respected the work that each of the lawyers put into their case. I can tell that they worked hard. And it just really, really emphasized how important serving as a juror is as citizens. It's important to protect the rule of law and to help ensure fairness in our judicial system. It's imperative that we all make time to serve. Despite the work obligations, make the time to serve because you make a difference in a fellow citizen's life. And it's transformative, and it was really a rewarding experience. I'm so glad I did it, and it gives me a new respect for all of the trial lawyers out there because I've been on both sides and just heightened my respect for the whole process.
I love that. Well, Shantice Jenkins Floyd, thank you so much for being on the show today. Really appreciate you giving your perspective and helping us to understand what it's like to be a juror. Really appreciate it today.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks to Litigation Section premier sponsor, Berkeley Research Group, for sponsoring this podcast. BRG is an award-winning global consulting firm composed of world-class experts in accounting, damages analysis, economics, finance, intellectual property, valuation, data analytics, and statistics, who work across industries, disciplines, and jurisdictions. Delivering clear perspectives that you can count on, their guiding principle is intelligence that works. Learn more at thinkbrg.com. And now it's time for a quick tip from the ABA Litigation Section's Mental Health and Wellness Task Force. And I'd like to welcome Aaron Clifford back to the podcast. Erin is a lawyer and director of marketing and business development at Clifford Law Offices in Chicago. She provides overall management of strategic business development, such as planning, coordination, and implementation of marketing and business plans. She is also the founder of Erin Clifford Wellness, where she works with families, professionals, and corporations in creating and maintaining healthy lifestyles through nutrition, life, and wellness coaching. Welcome back to the show, Erin.
Thanks, Dave.
Well, I understand you're going to be talking about lifestyle strategies for today. So what's your quick tip?
So my quick tip is that spring is the perfect time to spring into a happier, healthier well-being. So when I think of spring, it's all about rebirth and renewal, which makes it the perfect time to turn over a new leaf and give yourself a fresh start. Just as our physical spaces may be neglected and become entangled with the messiness of life during the coldest months, so does the space within our mind, body, and spirit. And this is especially true for those of us in the legal profession who often struggle with chronic stress and burnout. So I have six simple strategies that can be super helpful as we come into this season and carry you through the nice warmer months. So first off, we want to clear space by making what I like to call a burn list. So first, you want to think about any negative emotions that might be taking up space within your mind and body. Maybe there's a goal that hasn't come to fruition. Maybe there's a toxic relationship in your personal or professional life. Perhaps you're feeling disappointed, resentful, angry, or frustrated about something. Or maybe you're just constantly engaging in that negative self-talk. So now grab a pen and paper and write down a list of things that you think are negatively impacting your well-being and you want to let go of. And once you've done your list, you're going to either burn it or tear it up as a symbol to move forward this spring with a new mindset. And this can be a really fun exercise to do with your family, friends, or even your colleagues. Next, a great way to get a little spring cleaning is to actually go in and clean out those external spaces. Because the physical act of cleaning and decluttering can actually improve our mental and physical health. It can increase our productivity and mood. And we're all very busy. So I always advise my clients to start small and just pick up one area of your office or home. Maybe it's a drawer. It could be part of your closet. And organize piles of keep, throw away, and give away. And set a schedule and do it on multiple days. We don't want this to stress you out more. And you want to make it entertaining. So listen to your favorite podcast or audiobook or music. Also, spring is a great time to add in some mindfulness to your routine, which is going to promote some more mental positivity. And how can you do this? You can do this by meditating. Just starting with 5 minutes a day, if this is something new to you, there's lots of guided meditations online or apps such as Calm or Headspace. You can also practice gratitude by just writing down 5 things a day or thinking on them, things that you're grateful for. Over time, this can really shift your mindset. Do a digital detox. We're always on our phones and computers too much. So commit to cutting back on social media, shopping, news websites, especially before bedtime. And exercise. Moving is one of the absolute best things you can do for a mental boost. And I always tell my lawyers, schedule it in your calendar like you would every other appointment, because otherwise we have a tendency to put it off. And speaking of exercise, making sure we practice some self-care every day is really important. And what is self-care? It's really about taking the time to do things that you enjoy and supporting your routines with exercise, healthy nutrition, mindfulness, sleep hygiene. It can be as simple as having a cup of tea in the afternoon or planning a vacation. Also, maintaining those boundaries. Getting a haircut or manicure, making sure you go to your doctor's appointments. And I know we're all really busy, but you are worth at least a 5-minute pocket of self-care every day. Next, make sure you still are connecting with others. As busy lawyers, we often neglect our connections with friends, family, and colleagues, and even sometimes the people we live with. How often are you sitting at the dinner table and everyone's on their phone instead of really enjoying each other's company? So make a point this season to connect with others by either sending a text, an email, a call, scheduling a walk, a coffee date, maybe during a meetup over the weekends. You know, I always like to tell my clients, all the success in the world cannot hug you back. And finally, give yourself grace. We often set the bar highest for ourselves. So this spring season, cultivate some self-compassion and empathy by allowing yourself to be less than your idea of perfect. Because after all, perfect is really boring.
Well, thanks, Erin, for those really helpful tips. And thanks for being here today.
Thank you.
Well, that's all we have for our show today, and I'd love to hear your thoughts about today's episode. If you have comments or a question you'd like for me to answer on an upcoming show, you can contact me at dscriven-young@pecklaw.com and connect with me on social. I'm at AttorneyDSY on LinkedIn, Instagram, X, and Facebook. You can also connect with the ABA litigation sections on those platforms as well. But as much as I'd like to connect with you online, nothing beats meeting you in person at one of our next litigation section events. So please make plans to join us at the 2024 Section Annual Conference in Washington, D.C., taking place May 1st through the 3rd. The Section Annual Conference is the premier event for litigators. It brings together top litigation professionals from across the U.S. to discuss timely legal issues and the latest in trial advocacy, litigation strategy, and case management. The conference will include over 20 dynamic programs highlighting all aspects of litigation. There, of course, will be multiple opportunities to network during the programming breaks and breakfasts, as well as the welcome reception, networking luncheon, International Spy Museum reception, and the John Minor Wisdom and Diversity Leadership Luncheon. To find out more and for registration information, go to ambar.org/SAC2024. If you like the show, please help spread the word by sharing a link to this episode with a friend or through a post on social, and invite others to join the show and community. If you want to leave a review over at Apple Podcasts, it's incredibly helpful. Even a quick rating at Spotify is super helpful as well. And finally, I want to quickly thank some folks who make this show possible. Thanks to Michelle Oberts, who's on staff for the litigation section. Thanks also goes out to the co-chairs of the litigation section's audio content committee, Haley Maple and Tyler True. Thank you to the audio professionals from Legal Talk Network. And last but not least, thank you so much for listening. I'll see you next time.